The folklorist Lynn McNeil told us this week that food has never just been about sustenance. It's always bound up in a lived experience. So it takes on what she says is this symbolic weight, not just the aroma or the flavor, but the memory of it. So food is love, and it's tradition. Just think about it, the cinnamon rolls you made with your grandma, or shelling peas for your mom, blanching tomatoes in a hot kitchen, waiting for the bing of the timer. You sit and visit. And you weren't just preparing food. You were building a connection from the past to that very moment. It's what happened to Eleni Saltis. She's a personal trainer and a food blogger in Salt Lake City.
When I was younger, I was definitely a finicky eater. I was much of a macaroni and cheese out of the box. And I actually still love macaroni and cheese. But I was one of those that had, you know, those plates that are separated. I needed those. Like, that's how, like, weird I was with food. And vegetables were out of the question. I would feed my food to my dog, or I would put a mouthful of food in my mouth and go into the bathroom and spit it out. I had a lot of tricks. My relationship with food probably started changing when I was in my 20s. There's a tradition in our family. For every New Year's, we make these things called lukumadas. And they're basically Greek honey donuts. And you top cinnamon and honey and chop walnuts on it. And I would go to my aunt's house. Her name was Mary. Fried oil makes me think of her. It's funny. Even though she was small, she was mighty. And she would make these lukumadas every New Year's Eve. Up into her 90s, she was pumping out these donuts. And I wanted to learn from her. In the kitchen, she would show me how to do that and then kind of make me dive in right away. She was going like 3 times my speed, and I was like, I need to be like her. I need to emulate her in any way. I sat with her, got her story, learned how to make them, and then I wanted to do that with other recipes. I'm very appreciative that I did that, because without that, those recipes would be lost. Those light bulb moments made me want to preserve those recipes and try and get that motivation to other people, to inspire them to do the same with their parents, their grandparents, their aunts, whatever. When I cook, there's history behind it, in either with my family or traditional Greek cooking and where it came from and why, and the humble foods and the beginnings of it. And so it kind of makes me think a lot more of preparing foods and why I do it and how it's done. It's not just throwing things together. It's combining ingredients that are traditional and simple. I now am tending to a garden, growing tomatoes, cucumbers, zucchinis, eggplant, all these foods that I hated, I'm now growing and turning them into meals. When I make something for someone, that's my love language, is cooking for people. It's just a lot of fun ways to tie in my family history into making it my own now. So I'm very grateful to be able to step outside and kind of relax in the garden and just think of a lot of good memories.
Eleni Saltis. She has a cookbook called All You Can Greek. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So what is it that comes to mind when you think Utah food? Because we have this conversation from time to time. What exactly is Utah food? And we wanted to move the idea past the Jell-O and funeral potatoes. And we will move past it, I promise. But Jell-O and funeral potatoes are a fixture of Mormon culture. Not the only one, but they are. And it was something that interested Daniel George. He's a photographic artist. He has an exhibit at the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art. It's a collection of photographs of the Utah foods that interest him. It's called marrow.
I guess this project stems from my youth and growing up in the church outside of Utah, where I would be approached by kids at school or wherever who knew me, and they'd, you know, say, "Oh, you're Mormon." Like, yeah. And then they would proceed to tell me something about myself. And I would try and figure out like where they were coming from with that.
Right.
At the time, you know, maybe as a kid, that slightly annoyed or frustrated me. Like, yeah. Well, that's not who I am. Where'd they get that idea? But as an adult, I started to think about it a little bit more and how this region of the country, and because of the predominant religious culture and how that affects the social culture, how that then in turn affects the way that members worldwide are viewed or perceived. Mm-hmm. So it was that aspect of culture that was interesting to me. And I found myself in the winter with a bit of time. So I thinking about these ideas of culture, religious identity of the state, I started thinking about Jell-O. It's the official state snack of Utah. And so I started thinking about how that symbol represented the state and the culture to a degree. So I, while I was teaching at BYU, got into the special collections in the library where they had a bunch of Ward cookbooks and started looking at all the Jell-O recipes and thought, well, I want to try, you know, making a bunch of this Jell-O and photographing it just kind of for fun as a side project. Mm-hmm. And then that snowballed into an interest in just Mormon cuisine in general, like all the foods and how they represent various aspects of culture.
Explain what people will see when they go to the exhibit. To me, it seemed a little bit like these were pieces of still life. They're very stylized, some of them anyway, with color. Explain what people are going to see.
So when people walk into the show at Utah Museum of Contemporary Art, they would see photographic prints of foods like Jell-O, like funeral potatoes, like various casserole dishes, soups. There are also Ward cookbooks. The show is unframed. All the prints are just hanging on the wall. Mm. I wanted the feel of the show to be a lot like the experience of entering an LDS building for a potluck, where it's a little, it's accessible feeling. It's maybe a little bit more lowbrow, maybe utilitarian, kind of just, it serves a function to feed people.
Yeah.
And for some of the images, I did want to kind of just push the quirkiness and the absurdity and the artificialness of the food items, like Jell-O. I thought would look good just surrounded in plastic.
That seems right to me. I guess, is there a larger statement that you're making there? I don't know, that might be critical of American mass consumption, that might say something about the kind of static nature of suburban Latter-day Saints, you know, something maybe more ironic. I mean, because it reminds me a little bit of, you know, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the work of the painter Wayne Thiebaud. He's got cakes and ice cream cones and pies that are kind of a commentary about mass consumption. Are you getting at something like that with this?
I more or less try and ask questions with my work rather than make statements. I mean, certainly I have my views on Jell-O and certain industrially processed foods. But when I was making the work, I was basically had the question in mind. It's like, you know, these photographs, what do they show of people hungry for? And, you know, recording these recipes and dishes in these cookbooks, which become history books and kind of a standard of LDS cuisine, you know, what does it show about their appetites or their passions or their desires?
Hmm. Explain a little bit the way you are describing the certain sections, the Jell-O pieces you call primary, the funeral potato collection, those are passion pieces.
Yes.
There's a section that has some green bean casseroles and there's punch and brownies and dinner rolls. That's a section you call doctrine.
Yes.
The food utensils, the serving tools, the spatulas, the ice cream scoops, stuff like that, you call disciples. So, which makes sense to me, I have to say. There's disciples, there's doctrine, there's passion pieces. This is, why use these words?
Yeah. So as I was working on the project and doing a little bit of, I mean, using those cookbooks as like research, there would be lots of poems and artwork contained in some of the cookbooks. I couldn't find a use for them in the show though I wanted to, but they were all drawing comparisons or lines to like between religious beliefs and food. And so with the titles of the pieces, I wanted to allude to some of those things. Like there's a grid of 63 cookbooks on one wall in the gallery. And that piece is titled Scripture, being that it's, you know, those are the books that contain those, like the written word, the history, those, you know, recipes that, you know, I might jokingly describe as sacred, you know, as they're passed down from generation to generation. The doctrine pieces, those are, I selected the food items and described them as doctrine because those are like the dishes that perhaps are most common, most typical at a ward potluck.
Yeah.
And then funeral potatoes, we had mentioned those ones. Those are passion pieces. That was me being a little bit leaning into my sense of humor a little bit, where there are, you know, depictions of the passion of Christ. And it's like, well, could I recreate something like that? It's like funeral potatoes. There's an association with death in the name of the food. And so thinking about depictions of Christ later in his life and with his death and resurrection, I wanted to create a piece that referenced that. And so, yeah, really with the names of the pieces, it was very much drawing parallels with religious views, with the food culture.
The overall title is Marrow. What do you mean by marrow? How are you thinking about that word?
So it took me a while to come up with the name of the show. The residency, so I was part of the Artist in Residence program at Utah Museum of Contemporary Art. And throughout that year-long period of time when I began making photographs and researching, I would write down names every once in a while. And I like when names, there are a couple ways that you can interpret it. And with that particular name, I was thinking about how marrow is used within LDS culture, scripture, referencing health or like a healthy lifestyle. But then also it can be interpreted as the core or essence of something. And so that dual meaning kind of stuck in my mind as, yes, being both about health, but then we have these, you know, food items that represent what is consumed and what that might say about this particular people, and how all of the food items in the show could be a good cross section as to what Mormon cuisine might be described as or visualized as. Mm.
You told the Salt Lake Tribune that you were interested in making this work as a way of considering that food can be something beyond just sustenance. Mm-hmm. And here's something you said to the Tribune. You said, what does it say about culture, particularly the predominant religious and social culture of the state of Utah? So what does it say? And maybe you don't want to answer that question. Again, you're probably more interested in the question than the answer, but I don't know if you could venture, what does this say about LDS culture and the social culture of the state? If you could put your finger on it.
Typically when I like write about my work or talk about my work, I like to leave it open to a degree for interpretation. But I mean, you know, I kind of look at it as, with that question of beyond sustenance, what does it say about a culture that consumes these things? And I mean, I see personally with and it's mostly perhaps related to the ingredients that are used. There are a lot of industrially processed foods. They're very, a lot of the dishes are like, you know, add this, let it sit for, you know, bake for however long. And it's like easy and ready to go. I mean, it does say something about family and community that perhaps, with this desire to get together, to eat together, there's like a practicality in the way that the dishes are produced in order to be able to provide for a lot of people. So I mean, that's one thing that I see with the food items specifically is that, that component of being able to prepare things easily, quickly in order to have time to get together with others and spend time with other people.
Hmm. I want to ask you, I'm going to come back to the cookbook project finally. We see, as you said, this grid of Mormon ward cookbooks, and you've talked about them functioning like artifacts of history and culture. And the idea of them being a history made me wonder, are they artifacts from the past? That is, are people still making these things? Or is this something from, I know there are still ward parties. I'm not asking that. And I know people still bring funeral potatoes and brownies, but those cookbooks, are they still doing those?
You know, the cookbooks that I acquired range from, I think, as early as the 50s and 60s to the 2010s.
Huh.
And so, yeah, I think that it's very much still a part of various wards' cultures to put together these cookbooks. You know, what the newer one, I can't say for sure, but I haven't seen one from the past like 5 years or so. And so I'm not sure what
it just seems like. It'd be different. Google Doc that has all the recipes of everyone in, you know, in a particular religious congregation, that's different from thumbing through and, you know, and getting dirty a cookbook. It's mm-hmm. There's just something seems more tactile about that experience, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no soul to a Google Doc, is there? You can't write notes in it, get it dirty.
Yeah. How are people reacting to the exhibit?
I've been able to, with various events that have gone on at the museum, there was an opening reception back in August, and then with a potluck we just had here in late September, the reception from people that I talked to, they really enjoyed it. They thought that it was fun and intriguing, and you know, I can hope for that, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, Daniel George, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Doug.
Daniel George, he's a photographic artist and a lecturer in the art and design department at Utah Valley University. His exhibition is called Marrow. It's showing now at the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Utah's state legislative session is just 45 days long. That is not a lot of time to get all the business done, Sonia.
Not at all, Emily. It is a very complicated process, and a lot needs to happen in those few weeks. On the next episode of State Street, we're learning about what goes into that short legislative session and whether the process still holds up.
Find State Street wherever you listen to podcasts or go to KUER.org/State Street.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Utah food, whatever that is. And that's part of what we're talking about. What is it that qualifies as Utah food exactly? Because this place is changing. And we've always been more than just green jello and hard dinner rolls. Joining us on the program is Allison Enerson. She's the executive director of Urban Food Connections of Utah. Lynn McNeil is also with us. She's an associate professor of English at Utah State University, co-founder of the Digital Folklore Project. Lynn goes first.
It's not just that Utah has not been associated with a particular cuisine. It's almost as if its reputation, and I'm talking about among outsiders here, not among Utahns, has almost been one of anti-cuisine. Utah's reputation as having large families who store food had a definite quantity over quality idea to it. The lack of alcohol, the lack of caffeinated beverages, which are two things that often are paired with finer cuisines in other places, just sort of doubles down on that reputation. And you can go to other parts of the country where there's an expected cuisine. I'm going to eat Tex-Mex food. I'm going to eat, you know, buffalo wings. I'm going to eat barbecue. And you know, you can picture the regions where those foods come from. For a really long time, people pictured Utah and it was sort of a blank slate.
Hmm. All right, let me ask you, Allison, you answer this one first. First thing that comes to mind when I say Utah food, first thing comes to mind.
Funeral potatoes and fry sauce, right? I think that's what most people think. For me, it's very much like grass-fed cattle and vegetables, because that's the world I live in. One really great example, I think, of the sort of pioneering what Utah food can be is really what Blake and Jen are doing down at Hell's Backbone. What grows here? What can live here? What can survive here? We know we can do really great grass-fed cattle. Chickens are easy and relatively inexpensive. And then we grow a lot of really amazing vegetables and, you know, the orchards and the fruit trees that we have. So when I think about Utah food, that's what I think about. And I think that is evolving as an idea of a Western-based cuisine.
So that gets to the question that I'm wondering about. You hear the Jell-O thing, you hear the funeral potatoes thing. So are a lot of these ideas just kind of boring at this point and really outdated? Because it seems like a kind of massive cliche at this point. Lynn, what do you think? And Allison, you too.
You know, I do think that it's a cliche, as are all stereotyped foods. You can find, you know, in any place that's famed for a specific type of food, whether it's considered good or bad, you're going to find other cuisines there as well. But in Utah, for me, like Allison, when I think of Utah foods in my lived experience, it comes back to my garden and how I didn't garden before I lived here, or preserve food or canned food or make sauces from scratch. And that's something that I associate with Utah and its incredible history of farming and land cultivation and all of those different elements. In some ways, Utah almost skipped the foodie movement and went straight to locavorism and farm to table and this realization that Utah was primed to really kind of meet some of those even newer movements. And that's been integral to my experience and understanding of Utah food. So we absolutely have those iconic images. And the book acknowledges that. The iconic food section includes things like green Jell-O and fry sauce and funeral potatoes, but it also includes unexpected things as iconic Utah foods like Greek pastrami burgers and alcohol. And knowing that means that we really do now live in a time of a far different understanding, a far more nuanced and complex understanding of what we mean when we say Utah food.
Allison, you've talked about the fact that the Utah palate is evolving and evolving pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think it is. I also think it's important to note that you can throw all Jell-O away, but you can put a really well-made funeral potato casserole made from scratch up against any, you know, French gratin, and it's delicious.
It's true. We
don't need to throw that away. It's good if you do it right.
Yeah.
And fry sauce, I mean, come on. There's a reason that fry sauce is the dominant condiment here. It's because if you do it right, it's delicious.
Agreed.
And so I think that's important. You know, like you can do things and make them well. And yeah, they're stereotypes, but they're also really delicious when they're done correctly. And they have a place in our culture, and there's no reason to throw them away.
Yeah.
Jell-O can go. It's fine. No one cares about that. But yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of part of the conversation. Like, I think we're evolving our own traditions in a way that are really, really interesting.
You know, this is more than just about sustenance. In the book, Lynn, you write about what you describe as this food having this symbolic weight. That it's about, you know, the foraging part and the preparing part and, as you put it, the intentional construction of these textures and flavors and tastes. And I love this quote you include in the book from MFK Fisher. Our three basic needs for food and security and love are so mixed and mingled and entwined that we cannot straightly think of one without the others. So what? Food is security. Food is love. It's more than just something you take into your body, I guess.
Yes, and the fact that we do take it into our bodies is one of the ways that we take security and love into our bodies. It really is this incredible metaphorical act. I mean, we could survive probably on some sort of horrific protein shakes as a species if we needed to, but we don't want to. And when we think about the incredible moments of human connection, the holidays, the celebrations, the rituals that we mark with special foods and foods that we make for another person. It's this incredibly intimate act of procuring food and preparing food and serving food and then consuming it by ourselves or with other people, and all these background expectations that we have that we don't even think about. Why do I use the utensils I use? Why do I consider certain foods breakfast foods and other foods dinner foods and other foods special foods or holiday foods? What distinguishes those things? That has incredible cultural weight, so much so that food is one of the main sources of culture shock or homesickness when we travel to a place with a wildly different cuisine. It shows us how important those things that we so easily overlook in our daily lives actually are.
Allison Lynn writes about in the book how part of this is the daily lived experience of eating, which she describes as being rich with culture and meaning. Does that resonate with you, the idea that this is connected to a lived experience and that in that sense it sort of plays into culture?
Absolutely. Every year I try to do, you know, however many jars I can do, I do a chili sauce, which is an adaptation of my grandmother's chili sauce.
Yeah.
And it takes all day. I got to go out. I got to pick all the tomatoes. You got to blanch all the tomatoes. You got to go get some onions. You know, it's a really all day long process. And it was taught to me at my grandmother's knee. And so when I make that, that is, you know, it's an 8-hour, very intentional process to get to what is essentially ketchup. But, you know, then when I feed that to my child, I get to share the story of how I used to make it with my grandmother and how I used to help her pick her tomatoes. And it's intrinsically tied to culture, and you can buy chili sauce in the store. I don't recommend it, but you should make your own if you can.
I wanted to ask about a few characteristics of Utah food, some Utah food anyway. And I guess this seems obvious now that I think about it, but Lynn, you say that sugar, the indulgence of sugar, has really shaped the palate of the state. Talk about that.
Yeah, this is an interesting thing. And it's funny because if you look at the book, I wrote all the vice chapters. If it's about alcohol, I wrote it in this book, which, you know, let's not read too much into that. But one of of all the things that I had to say about the relationship of a controlled substance like alcohol to the state of Utah, the thing I was most sort of stressed about talking about was sugar, because it's a delicate thing to say, hey, there's a dominant palate in this state, or has been. It's changing. It's definitely changing. But for a long time, sweetness was really the go-to flavor in a society where the dominant religion eschews alcohol and caffeine. It pretty much erases the bitter and the sour flavor profiles that go along with dark coffee, with beer, with wine. And those are, in other regions, flavor profiles that are associated with adulthood. As you get older and are able to drink coffee and alcohol, it is expected that your tastes will change. And so then your food interests lean perhaps a little bit more toward those uncomfortable flavors like sourness and bitterness and complexity. And in a population where adulthood isn't marked by that changing palate, how do you distinguish adulthood from childhood? Well, more sugar. Adults can have more ice cream or treats or whatever. It becomes sort of a quantity thing. And we can see that. We have a chapter in the book on mixed sodas as a phenomenon in Utah, restaurants that take mixology, the ideas of espresso drink mixing and cocktail mixing, and apply them to sodas with flavored sugared syrups added into them. And we see these huge sugar bombs becoming these iconic flavors of Utah. And that's a really distinct regional interest.
It's interesting. You mentioned that one characteristic of this part of Utah food is that you see sweet ingredients added into savory dishes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's a thing that happens in other cuisines. We get fruit in curry on pizza. It's not unheard of.
Yeah.
But I will say that the first time I encountered marshmallow fluff being mixed into chicken salad and put on a sandwich, I just about fainted. I mean, it took everything in me to politely chew and swallow and smile and say thank you and not immediately spit it out. And I, you know, no offense to anyone who really likes marshmallows in their chicken salad, but wow, that was a you know, a step too far for me.
Allison, how much does our local restaurants affect what we think of as Utah food? I can think of a Crown Burger. I can think of a pastrami burger. That I think of that as Utah food. What's the connection there? What's the relationship there? And then also on that point, are you starting to see in Utah restaurants, maybe in a kind of wry, ironic way, an embrace of things like funeral potatoes and green bean casseroles? Are you seeing people deconstructing iconic Utah foods? Like, what's the relationship, I guess, between restaurants and what we think of as Utah food?
I think there are two different camps. I mean, there is sort of the iconic sort of fast food, you know, your Crowns, your Apollos, those kinds of things that are really tied to Utah. And then there is, I think, a newer restaurant culture that is coming up that started, you know, more than a decade ago with restaurants like Pago, who were interested in doing, you know, place-based food. Hell's Backbone, obviously, as I mentioned before. The idea of place-based food, what can you serve here elegantly that is actually authentic to this place? And I think there's a lot more of that happening. And I think there's a lot of deconstruction, as you say, happening. There's a few really great restaurants that are having a lot of fun with playing with things like, you know, an upscale tuna sandwich or, you know, whatever it might be. I think there is a lot of that happening. It takes, you know, it takes someone who has grown up here in the culture to understand how to take those apart and be, I hate to use the word reverent to them in a certain way. But it's true. You have to understand this place in order to really get, to understand. You have to, you just kind of have to have been here for a while or grew up here. I don't know. But I think that is starting to happen, and I can think of a handful of restaurants that are doing that in a really exciting way. And I embrace it. I love it.
Yeah. So we need to point out that this is not, of course, just Mormon influence. There's particular Utah stories related to Asian food and Polynesian food and Italian food and Greek food, just to name a few. Mm-hmm. But Lynn, I wanted to ask you, there's this section in the book about the influence of indigenous people to so-called Utah food. And it's a piece about how the various native people in this region, the Dene, the Southern Paiute, the Ute, Shoshone, among others, cultivated plants like maize and crookneck squash and field pumpkins. But the piece points out that white settlers never really acknowledged these foods or the care that was used to cultivate them. Mention something about that, if you would.
Yeah, this is an interesting point in Utah history because one of the large points of pride of the pioneers and their descendants was this idea that they made the desert bloom. So much is made about that pre-blossomed state, about how it was, you know, a wasteland and unlivable and desolate, when in reality there were people living there for many years prior to the arrival of any pioneers or white settlers, who were doing a very fine job of making that desert bloom themselves. It was a different method and a different style, and one that maybe interpreted various situations differently. The plague of crickets that the pioneers, you know, have made much of was something that was seen as an opportunity for food by most of the native peoples who lived here. That was a substantive part of their diet. So that working with the landscape and the ups and downs that it provided was something that was an immense element of living here. And the fact that sustainable gardening and harvesting was taking place for so long really speaks against this idea that Utah was a wasteland before pioneers arrived. And I think that that's something that we see a regaining appreciation for as a part of the development of Utah foods now contemporarily. The entire idea for this Utah food culture book was conceived of in the Black Sheep Cafe in Provo, which is contemporary fusion Native American cuisine. And we see a lot of old traditional foods being used, you know, lamb and mutton and squash. And we see a lot of of new foods and styles of cooking being used as well to really create this super local, you know, super contemporary cuisine that really couldn't exist anywhere else. So what we're really doing is expanding our understanding of food history in Utah. It absolutely is a major accomplishment. The irrigation systems that pioneers and their descendants put in this state. But we can't overlook the centuries of work before that, that human beings were doing to survive and thrive in these same desert climates.
You know, one of the things that I think of when I think of Utah food that comes to mind for me almost first, and that is chokecherries. Because my mother, she and the ladies in the ward would always go up to Buckland Flats and pick chokecherries when it was time, and they would make chokecherry jam and chokecherry jelly and chokecherry syrup. Allison, I'm wondering if you're seeing more of presence of these kind of native plants like huckleberries and mountain strawberries and chokecherries. I mean, I was delighted to see that Amore Spreads, who make these great jams, they do a chokecherry jam now. Like, they go out and harvest those jams. Are we seeing more of that, I guess?
Yeah, I do think we're seeing more of that. I think we're seeing a lot more of people. Like, I have friends who love to go foraging for mushrooms up near the Uintas. That's happening a lot more. Yeah, chokecherries, huckleberries, blackberries. I mean, so many of the things that, you know, they're hard to kill, let alone, you know, easy to grow, easy to harvest, hard to kill. So, yeah, I think we're seeing a return to that. I'm so glad you mentioned the Black Sheep Cafe, because it is a stunning example of how to turn beans and squash into one of the most incredible meals you've ever had, and to really get an appreciation for what does grow here and what has sustained people for thousands of years. You know, you see pretty much a lot of the traditional stuff that you'll see anywhere at the farmer's market, but we are starting to see some more unique and native plants coming back.
Allison Enerson, she's the executive director of Urban Food Connections of Utah. Lynn McNeil is an associate professor of English at Utah State University. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER is proud to be a listener-supported public radio station. We'd like to thank our community of more than 10,000 sustainers who make a monthly contribution to the station, starting at just $5 a month. Because of your support, all the news, stories, and conversations that you hear are independent, calm, and commercial-free. If something you heard on KUER made a difference to you recently, become a new sustainer or increase your existing pledge at KUER.org/donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Don't tell a Greek or Italian immigrant to the state Utah doesn't have a cuisine. We're talking about Utah food today, trying to understand what it is exactly. And what we've learned this week is that Utah food is strip mall restaurants started by refugees. It's Mexican markets and street tacos. Utah food is chokecherries and Navajo mutton stew. And sure, Utah food is also green jello. Back now to our conversation with Allison Enerson and Lynn McNeil. We're approaching now the end of the growing season, and so everyone's tomatoes are coming in, and, you know, we're past certain points. The melons are at a certain point, and squash is at a certain point. And I'm wondering, how are you, both of you, thinking about, Lynn, you mentioned it, Allison, I know you think a lot about this, the traditions this year that you have for, you know, putting up preserves, for canning? Like, what are you thinking about right now in that way?
Well, I'll go first. I'm thinking I should be at home putting up food, but I'm not. So, yeah, I mean, it is right now you have at least, I mean, if we're lucky, if it doesn't freeze, we'll have, you know, 4 or 5 more weeks in the growing season. And yeah, literally everything is on right now except for maybe asparagus, right? So now is the time. And I think, you know, I've taught canning classes in the past. I do a lot of food preservation on my own. But what I would like for people to think about is just like, what is the easiest thing I can do right now? And that might be dicing up a zucchini and sticking it in your freezer. to throw it into soup, you know, sometime in January. You don't have to go invest in a bunch of equipment. You don't have to be an expert. You don't have to take a class. You can start really simply by just cutting some vegetables up or some fruit and throw them in your freezer. And once you sort of start that cycle, you gain a really, first of all, it helps you eliminate food waste, which is a huge concern of mine personally. But it also just, it just kind of starts you on that path of like, what will I look forward to in January? And I know frozen peaches are going to make me super happy in January. So start small. And then, you know, if you start to become obsessed with it, like me, hit my website and I'll teach you how to put up some salsa.
Yeah. Lynn, what about you?
Allison, I am so glad to hear you say that, because looking at me right now on my kitchen counter are two giant zucchinis that are waiting to be diced up and frozen. So my garden this year is almost wholly dedicated to pizza sauce. I have a wood-fired pizza oven in my yard, and I have just increasingly specialized in just producing massive quantities of pizza sauce from my garden. So I'm hoping to get in one more batch of basil before it freezes so that I can make pesto, so that I can add it to pizza sauce. I don't know why, but I have a lot of green tomatoes this year, so I'm going to have to figure out something to do with the ones that didn't ripen. I feel that this is a little bit of the overwhelming panic point in the year as the frosts are starting to come and it's getting colder. What am I going to be able to use? What am I going to be able to store? How am I going to be able to store it? But it speaks to that connection to the natural world, whether that's through a garden or simply through the weather or the seasons or a community garden or a farmer's market, that awareness of the cycle of the seasons and the passage of time, I think, is one of those background elements of being interested in food and food cultures that is one of the most grounding elements.
So you guys don't worry about something like mustard pickles or chokecherry jelly, like just disappearing, vanishing. You figure there's enough interest from younger people that will take up some of these traditions that we're not going to lose it. You don't worry about that?
I don't personally worry about it, no. I think there's a huge uptick in interest, especially in like the 30-something generation. There's a huge uptake in, I think, just the connection to food, food waste, the environmental movement, climate change. People are being really thoughtful about it. And I personally will die before I let mustard pickles go the wayside.
thank you.
I agree completely, both about mustard pickles and in general. We are seeing a huge upswing in interest in things like canning and preserving and gardening. But even on a broader scale than that, when I think about this as a folklorist and more generally about folklore, folk culture and the expressions of it, by definition, rise and fall as we need them. And so, yeah, some traditions, some practices, some customs are going to fall by the wayside. But when we are ready for them again, they get revived. They come back. Mm-hmm. We dig up past generations recipe books and you know, handbooks for how to can and preserve. And we seek out classes and instructors in this. And we learn how to do the things we again need to do. And when something is as important as locavorism and regional sustenance and sustainable living, it never stays gone for long. We might see it ebb and flow, but we're never going to see it depart entirely. So I'm less concerned with the specifics of will chokecherry jam specifically stick around. The making and preserving of jam will for sure. Chokecherries will for sure. We may see other trendy berries or fruits being used in the meantime, but it's not going to go away because it's based in our needs and we will always need those things.
Mm. Okay, let me ask you a final question. And this may be a stretch, but I'm wondering, we are a deeply divided country right now, and it's reflected in the state. You have people on the right, people on the left, if I were to oversimplify it. But do you think in some way that food, the gathering together of people, like I'm hoping that there are younger people who are reaching out to the older people in their lives and learning about how to make mustard pickles. And I wonder if you think in some way these traditions could be in some way healing. What do you think?
Without question. Hmm. Yeah, without question, I think they are. You don't need to talk about who anybody voted for. Just right. Peel those tomatoes, you know? I mean, it's really grounding. It's very connecting. I grew up here. I'm from here. I'm of this place. And does everyone have the same political beliefs as me and my family? Absolutely not. Do we all get together and put up food? Yeah, we do. And that is something that I'm not willing to let go. And, you know, am I going to always agree with my daughters on everything? No, but they're going to walk out of my kitchen knowing how to make grandma's chili sauce. Yeah. So that's my take on it.
Yeah, I mean, the consumption of food is a biological imperative. We have to do it. There's no way around it. So when we do it, let's make it as meaningful as possible. Let's do it consciously. Let's do it intentionally, which is not to say that we should not also totally embrace occasionally grabbing a fast food hamburger or a microwaved meal or anything like that. But even those more commercial ways of taking in food still hold meaning for us. One of my family's strongest food traditions was that every year at Christmas, we make Jolly Green Giant frozen broccoli and cheese sauce and then put it in this beautiful serving dish as though we made it from scratch. And you microwave it. We would microwave 7 bags of this stuff and then put it on the table and serve it to everyone. And that is such a meaningful food tradition that I can still enact because I can still run to the grocery store and buy that pre-packaged bagged food. Now, have I learned to make other better forms, perhaps, of broccoli and cheese sauce? Yes, but that one's going to hold a special place in my heart. And that's something where you don't need to be a gourmand. You don't need a whole special skill set to make food a meaningful way to connect with other people. And when we think again about the intimacy of the act of ingesting something that another person prepared for us with their own hands, their own time, their own sense of taste and what they find palatable that they want to share with us, you almost can't despise people that you're eating with.
It's so true. Lynn, I just have to tell you that I make a version of that same thing that is my mother-in-law's recipe. And it does have a stick of butter and it's covered with ground Cheez-Its.
Oh, my God.
Is that? Yes. Oh, it's. I don't want to leave you hanging out there alone that. On the Jolly Green Giant thing. Do I want to eat anything covered with, you know, ground up Cheez-Its? No, but that's not what it's about. It's about my husband's memory of his mother serving that to him at every Thanksgiving. So that's really what it's all about for me.
Allison, Lynn, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doug.
Allison Enerson, she's the executive director of Urban Food Connections of Utah, along with Lynn McNeil. She's a folklorist and an associate professor of English at Utah State University. She co-edited the book, This is the Plate, Utah Food Traditions. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Stu Nolan, the program produced by Carrie Watson, Benjamin Bombard, and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.